So last month, the New York Times featured this article that really got Brenly's attention, who sent it to me. It really got my attention, and I wanted to share with you today this really beautiful ritual that it talks about. It's an article by Rabbi Sharon Brous, who wrote the book The Amen Effect: Ancient Wisdom to Mend Our Broken Hearts and World. And the article is drawn from that, and in it, she's also the founder of the community, the Jewish community, ICAR, in Los Angeles. And this is actually, she uses this as a foundational philosophy for her community. And it's all based on this very obscure text written in about the third century. It's a legal compendium in Jewish texts. It's called the Mishnah. In it, there's this ritual that would happen in the Second Temple of Jerusalem. So we know how important the Jerusalem, metaphysically in the Bible, whenever you read Jerusalem or somebody going back to Jerusalem, it's like going back to center. It's the Mecca, it's home, it's the heart of the faith of the people. And so this idea, the Second Temple, this very early, significant place. Several times a year, the ritual is that hundreds of thousands of Jews would come. They would mount they'd go up the Temple Mount, and then as they entered into the plaza area, most people would turn right, and you would begin to walk in a counterclockwise circle. The rest of the people were people, anybody who was grieving or had a heavy heart would walk to the left. And in the ritual, as you walked, when you met one another coming in opposite directions, the person coming from the right would stop, look directly at the person in the eye who's coming from the left, and say, "What happened to you? What is causing your heart to ache?" And they would just hold space for the person to say, and often that other person might just say something very brief, "My mother died," or, "A spouse left and I feel blindsided," or "a child got ill." And then the other person would give them a blessing. "May the Holy One comfort you," or "You're not alone." And then they would continue on and meet the next person and the next and the next. These ancient rituals are so powerful. I see us doing this one on the Labyrinth. Yeah, whenever we need to. Whenever somebody in the community says, "I could use our ritual," whatever we're going to call it in Unity, where Unity speak. Maybe it's the Unity Mishnah ritual. So in this process, Rabbi Brous says this, that the implied understanding of the ritual is a knowing that next time I could be the one walking to the left. And so it's this shared humanity that reminds us over and over again that we're in this together, that this year you walk the path of the anguish, but perhaps next time it will be me who has the broken heart, and it will be you who holds me in compassion. And so it's with that we open ourselves. She says, asking with an open heart, "Why does your heart ache?" may be the deepest affirmation of our humanity. It's really, when you think about it, as spiritual beings having a human experience, isn't this what it's about? Isn't this why we come? To experience the depths of what it is to be a human being. And we sure are getting a lot of opportunity these days, aren't we? To experience the depth of what it means to be a human being. And as a spiritual person, remembering, I am that. I am the spiritual being. I have access to all the love, all the compassion, all the kindness that the world needs. It doesn't come from our own effort. It doesn't use up our energy because we let go and we open and we allow that ever-present spring of source to move through us. And it actually energizes us. It's quite the opposite of how we might think of it in a limited sort of way. So our grief does not heal. This is an important thing for us to remember. Our grief does not heal in isolation. We know this now, right? From different experience, from personal experience, maybe the researchers, you know, there's lots of literature out there that says it's not really how grief heals. Grief heals when somebody bears witness, when somebody holds space, when somebody prays, when somebody listens, when somebody says, may the Holy One comfort you, or you are not alone. So this is the journey of compassion. It's almost as if our hearts meet, even in a silent sort of blessing, and that the one heart that feels stronger today says to the other aching heart, I can't take your pain away, but I can promise you this, you're not alone. We can't fix it. We can't erase it. And it's not our process to do that, but what is ours is to see it, to hold it, to allow it, to accept it, to bless it, to acknowledge it. Not to just paper over, you know. Gaza just is really like, I feel like I carry that all the time. Do you feel that way? Yeah, it's just like, it's like at the bottom of all of our hearts, just like, and there's this knowing that even here, even in the midst of this utter inhumanity that we are experiencing on the planet in different places, I know Gaza's not the only one, Ukraine and other places, that opening, that allowing, that giving over to spirit, to recognize I cannot hold this alone, but there is an allness of spirit. There is a source of spirit. There is something I can tap inside of me that is so powerful, so able, so flowing of the power of love to heal and transform. If I just open the door and don't let the small stuff get in the way, let that stuff be left on the cutting room floor, if you will, unedited, you know, just flowing, just raw love. That's compassion in one of its forms. One of love's many forms, kindness, another, generosity, another. It's all connected, isn't it? We began this series of Jumpstart Your Heart 5 weeks ago with the idea of the law of circulation. And back then we talked about a story that really is all about compassion, a familiar biblical story called the Good Samaritan. And I'll just recap it again for those who are trying to remember right now. What is that story again? And so in that story, there is a man who is beaten and stripped naked and robbed and left for dead on the side of the road. And along comes a priest, and he crosses to the other side and leaves the man. And then next comes a Levite who, at that time and culturally, a Levite would have been considered a high-level, well-respected person. And a Levite man could choose to become a priest if he wanted. And if he became a priest, he would be considered higher than a regular priest. So along comes a Levite, crosses the road. The third who comes along is a Samaritan. And it's the Samaritan who stops, who binds the wounds of the man, who puts clothing on him, who puts him on a donkey, takes him to an inn, gives the innkeeper denarii, asks him to care for the man, and he'll be back in a few days to check on him again. Now, alone, the story is understandable, like just in its general understanding, we get the story, right? But also in its historical cultural context, it has another level of impact. Jesus is telling the story to Jewish people, and that Jewish audience is hearing it through a sense of expectation, right? We know which person is going to help. Of course, the Jew is going to help. Because Samaritans were not only considered lower than the Jews in the Jewish mind, but also they were arch enemies. And so the Samaritan is definitely not going to be the one to help, right? And then on top of it, these Jews that are coming along are a Levite and a priest? Yeah, this is a no-brainer, right? We know who's going to save the day here. So imagine how shocking it was then to them to hear this story at this other level, right? It would be like today. Here's a parable for today to use this story. Let's say a transgender person is left beaten, stripped naked, left for dead, robbed. It's not very much of a reach. And along comes a socially liberal person, crosses the street. Along comes another socially liberal person, crosses the street. The third person who comes is a self-proclaimed white supremacist. That's the one who helps. That's the one who binds up the wounds. That's the one who prays. That's the one who brings to the hospital. That's the one who pays. That's the one who comes and checks again. So often we have this fixed idea in our tribalism, and I can't think of a better term to say, but it shoots us in the foot of our work to do as spiritual beings, our walk on the spiritual journey. By thinking in those ways, we leave people out of the circle of our love, and our work as spiritual beings is to go to the edges of the circles of our love and say, who do I leave out? That's where my work is. That's where the work is, to kick the sand of that line that I create and cross it and invite them back into the circle of my love. This is what Jesus said. He said, love your enemies. It's easy to love the people who love you back. Go to the edges of the circle of your love, and that's where you do your work. Get out of the tribal mind that says, my people do this and your people, mm-mm. They would never save that person on the side of the road. How do you know? How do you know their heart? How do you know what goes through their minds? How do you know what they really, really believe or what they would do when push comes to shove? We don't. We don't. And our work is to expect us all to act like a good Samaritan. To expect that whoever you meet on the road, despite what they have done, will show up as a good Samaritan. And even when they don't, you can see heart to heart, soul to soul, divine spirit to divine spirit, the potential that is there, that maybe tiny light in the darkness that is the divine spark that can turn on a dime. So that's, I think, the edge of our work. When Dr. Amy Jill Levine comments on the parable of the Good Samaritan, she says this: this parable is a vision of life. It's not a vision of death. This parable, she says, it insists that enemies can prove to be neighbors, that compassion knows no boundaries, and that judging other people will leave us lying dead in the ditch. Whatever the basis of that judgment is, it doesn't matter. Our petty things, our big tribal otherness that we do, it's getting out of that mindset and getting into the consciousness of oneness that heals the world, the consciousness of love from which we are made. To remind ourselves and each other again and again and again, I walk the path of love. I'm made of love. I'm sourced by love. It's the easy path in some ways, because once it becomes a practiced way of being, this staying open, this keeping the heart open, this expecting the good and looking for the good as we enter an election year, expecting the good, looking for the good, being the love, being the source of love, being the divine presence, looking to going to the edge of my circle and to say, where is that circle where I constantly leave this person out or that group out and say, this is my work. Spirit, help me. Show me the way. Show me how I can kick down those places where I have created boundaries around my heart, because I want to feel the fullness and the power and the presence of the love I have come here to be. So how do we work with this? You know, when compassion, a compassionate heart compels us to do something, You know, when we are in our compassion, then there is these impulses of generosity come to us. Do you have those moments when you think, you know, I really want to write that person a note who did something very kind, or I experienced something of them, or I want to give, you know, financially to someone, or I want to write a good review for that kid behind the register that just went the extra mile so that, you know, and then you kind of get busy. Did anybody do this? And you don't do it? Yeah, I feel like this happens all the time to me. I have a really good thought, a really good intention. But if we stay in the compassion of our hearts, in the love of our hearts, it will become our priority. It will, our priorities will get reprioritized automatically because we are living a spirit, and spirit says, oh yeah, where there is good to be spoken, where there is good to be done, where there is an act of kindness or compassion or love, that is automatically our priority. Way more so than everything else you think you're supposed to be doing. And so it's that kind of living and walking and embodying that allows us to reprioritize our lives and to feel the joy that happens when we do, to feel the power of the love that moves through us and the connections that happen and what we feel like we're contributing then to the world, to help heal the world, to help transform ourselves, awaken ourselves as a whole human family. Bro says that showing up doesn't require heroic gestures. It means training ourselves to approach when we might have at least an egoic instinct to withdraw. Right? Whatever that is, that fear or protection or whatever it is that it kind of says, no, I don't think I will say anything to that person. But yet you see that person and, you know, their frown is going down to the floor, and you know they could use a little uplifting. And then you walk by because you don't know them. You don't want to get involved. But Spirit says, get involved. Get involved. Because that intuition is telling you this person needs a hand. They need a heart. They need a listen. They need a blessing. They need you to say, the Holy One will comfort you. They need you to say, you're not alone. It's one of the biggest hinges of compassion is to recognize that it is about shared humanity. Is it about a shared human experience? Kristen Neff is a self-compassion expert. She says this is like one of the big key elements is the isolation we tend to do when instead what we really need is a recognition of our shared humanity. And that's what compassion offers us. So it brings us to oneness, and it brings us to an understanding, too, that as we are in this together, pity has nothing to do with compassion. It's never about that. It's always about the spirit of recognizing we are together. The artist and activist Lily Watson said, "If you have come here to help me, you are wasting your time. But if you have come because your liberation is bound up with mine, then let us work together." And so it's a recognition constantly of that. There I go. Here I am meeting myself in the opposite direction. My brother, my sister, my sibling, my mother, my father, my parent, whatever it may be, my child. Here we are as family. And I do the best I can to open my heart and to be the compassionate presence I have come here to be. So here's an important piece in all of this. It's to recognize that there is also a component of self-compassion. So it seems like in Eastern culture, maybe Middle Eastern culture too, certainly in Jesus' understanding, and I think it seems like a lot of the Tibetan monks and others, that there is an innate understanding, of course you would have self-compassion. Of course you would have self-love. And in our Western culture, we have to put a fine point on that because we forget, right? We somehow leave ourselves out. It's not innately assumed that there is also self-compassion, that there is also self-love. I mean, it's clear when Jesus says, love your neighbor as yourself, he thinks it's a given that you're going to love yourself. And yet we say, well, is it? And so it's that also self-compassion, self-love that is such an important part of the equation. Because I think a lot of times we think, okay, giving to others, being compassionate, sharing with others, it means somehow we give away ourselves or that we get ourselves exhausted. And that's not what it's about. It's about tapping that oneness, tapping that source and just letting it flow. And also recognizing when we need to care for ourselves, when we need to reground ourselves in our own worthiness, in our own innate worthiness, regardless of what we say or do, right? That we are always worthy. We are always enough because we are made of spirit. We are in essence divine. We are in totality the whole spirit of love, the Holy Spirit. So there was years ago a story, actually you might know this story, it's been told many times. The woman is, the main character is Kiso Gotami. So this happened maybe, I don't know, 2,500 years ago or so, that Kiso Gotami's son, her only child, died. She was from a wealthy family. Her son was a baby, and she couldn't accept it. So she walked around with her son in her arms, asking everybody if they could help heal. And she'd go to all the doctors of the day and probably witch doctors of the day and all the different healers that she could find and maybe even just people on the street and just say, "What do you have any herbs? Do you have anything you could give my son to bring, you know, to help him heal?" And everybody was just kind of like, you know, he's not alive, you know. So finally somebody said, "Look, I think there's somebody you might be able to help you." And they sent her to what today, the person today who's known as the Buddha. And he said, "Yes, I think I can help you." He said, "So what I want you to do is go around and everybody you meet, go to different households and knock and ask for a mustard seed for every household that has not suffered loss. And then, you know, bring it back to me." And so she went, and she was knocking and knocking and knocking and knocking, and every door had no mustard seed because they had all experienced some kind of death in the family, some kind of loss. And so after a long while, it dawned on her, oh, everybody experiences this. And so she recognized and accepted the loss of her son. She buried her son. She went back to the Buddha. And she said, you know, "I have no mustard seeds." And she became a devoted follower of the Buddha from then on. So in this, back to this Jewish ritual, the Mishnah ritual, there's another part to it. Not only the people that walk left are in grief, but there are also people who walk to the left who have been ostracized. And it was part of, it was a rare punishment, but it was part of a punishment. I've heard of this also in the suddenly lost the Amish community, that it's you know, the social ostracizing that happens when somebody has done something to rent the social fabric of the community. Maybe it's a crime, maybe it's something else, who knows? And it's a pretty severe punishment because a person cannot participate in prayers, they're left out of a lot of the social gatherings, and so they're having this isolated experience. But every time this ritual happens, they're welcomed back in, and the same process happens. They walk, they meet somebody from the right, and a person says, "What happened to you? Tell me about your aching heart." And then gives them a blessing. This is pretty remarkable when you think about, you know, how we often deal with ostracized people in our world. What it brings to mind for me is a story from Anthony Hinton from Just Mercy. The book and the movie tells the story, his story, where he was on death row for 28 years, And he was denied, he was wrongly accused and denied justice at every turn. And he was just in such despair, he stopped speaking. He said that when no one believes a word you say, eventually you stop saying anything at all. Until one day, he was in his cell and he heard something. The man beside him started to cry. And he said, my compassion woke up. He said, he credits his mother. He said, I just started to feel it. And so much so that I spoke. And I asked the man why he was crying. And he said, his mother had just died. And he said, I surprised myself as I spoke, started to speak. And I said, look at it this way. Now you have somebody in heaven who can argue your case before God. And then he said, I told him a joke. He said, and I could feel my voice was coming back. And he, you know, and for 26 long years after that, he said, I tried to focus on other people's problems all day long, and I noticed whenever I did that, I was not aware of my own suffering anymore. And what Hinton did transformed that whole prison ward, that wing, death row wing, where the other men, mostly men, begin to also treat each other with greater compassion. So if it can happen in the most joyless place on earth, death row in prison, we can make this happen in our world, where we bring forth our compassion and our kindness, despite whatever circumstances are happening around us, despite what other people are doing, just to know, in our compassion, we do know this person is scared, this person is whatever, sad. They've been hurt in some way. And I can meet them on the higher ground of compassion and help them and help myself in the process. So compassion can heal entire communities. It can heal neighborhoods. It can heal workplaces. It can heal nations. And it can heal our world. It may seem like a lot to bite off and chew when we go all the way to the world. But if we think about it in this way, in these smaller gatherings of people, it then suddenly becomes more possible to our minds. So we started this series with the law of circulation. That idea is as we give, we receive. And compassion is certainly no exception to that, that there is an automatic flow, there is a circular motion, there is an experience when we are giving of ourselves, we receive also in compassion. The poet Elizabeth Alexander, who we heard from earlier, she says, are we not of interest to each other? That's it, right? Isn't it the clarion call of our times to take interest in one another? And so those who aren't in your regular purview or your bubble of ideology or whatever it is, whatever those bubbles are, we create your bubble of religion and so on. If we can see and think about, are we not of interest to each other? Don't you want to know a little bit about that person's walk? Aren't you curious? Because they are your sibling in this unity, human family. And I mean unity in the broad universal term when I say that. So we can act similarly to Hinton even, who came alive again, who found purpose again, by acting from this place, by listening and looking and pausing and reprioritizing to be that love in the world, to be that kindness in the world, to bring forth our compassionate heart. It's never too late. We can never sink too low, even though we may think we have, into a place of despair or depression or whatever it may be. There's always light. There's always love. There's always that line that we can grab a hold of through a prayer or an affirmation or a blessing, just a moment of hope and turn it all around. By giving to someone else, it opens up our curiosity. By giving to someone else, it resurrects our sense of purpose. Or by giving to ourselves in this way, right? And when we do this, this healing and transformation train begins to roll, right? And when it does, despair turns to hope, and hope turns to faith, and faith turns to everything that we would want, vitality and wholeness and prosperity and joy. Everything springs forth out of that place. So I hope all of us, as we go forth from this moment in time, from this place, from this beautiful sanctuary, that we carry with us in our hearts this idea that we are one, that we are a part of a family, that we are wired for compassion, for love, for kindness, to let our hearts just be open and giving. And in so doing, we will receive multiple times over. I'll be close to Gaza. I'm headed to Egypt here in a couple of days. And I somehow feel like even getting closer physically carries something. I'll be going with a group that is dedicated not to just a tour, but the whole group is dedicated to the evolution of humanity. That's the purpose of the tour, is to evolve humanity. A high bar, but that's the purpose of all of us in this room, is it not? It's what we all walk with day after day after day in our hearts as people on this spiritual journey, that we want to contribute to the evolution, the awakening, the opening, the recognition of the love that we are. And one of the ways we can do that is through the power of cultivating our compassion. I will miss you all. Oh, for those of you who don't know, I'm going on a 3-month sabbatical. I'll be back. I just heard somebody, saw somebody talking to somebody else, like, what's going on? What you talking about? So as we close this time together in this talk, in this series, let's speak this affirmation together and go forth freely sharing our compassion. Together, I freely share my heart of compassion. Bye, everyone online for now.